So, I have no other machines? Okay. Okay, so now this is it. It's interesting. This is even, Einsiedeln is even known among mountain bikers to be a special place. I just talked to a group of mountain bikers. They said they always come up to Einsiedeln, you know, have a lot of stress and physical exercise, and then they come here and relax, watch the monastery, and then go out and eat, you know. So this is a very special place, and I'm glad to talk to here. I chose the topic last year together with Kay, the topic distraction, fun, noise, so we can introduce with noise. The surrounding is working with us. Is our stress a defense against soul glimpse? So this is what I'm trying to do. So I'll first give a brief overview so you'll see what I'm trying to aim at, and then I'll continue. My lecture will have three parts. At the first part, I will make some general remarks about noise, stress, fun. So it will be more or less relating how do we act, what does actually fun mean, what does distraction mean, what does noise mean, what's the relevance of noise. So it will be more a little bit sociological, so the very first part. And then in the second part, I want to say something about the importance of Jungian analytical psychology. There I will point out the meanings of symbols and individuation, these core concepts of analytical psychology. And then in the third part, I will try to combine it. So I'll combine what I said at the second part with the first part in a third part. So you'll see what significance this first description has of what we're doing. And then I actually have a fourth part. And the fourth part will be about some conclusions. As Kay said, I work as a psychotherapist, analytical psychotherapist. I work at different areas. In some ways, I sometimes consider myself as a closet Jungian, because I work in the outside world, in surroundings, with the trains, with institutions, with also a sort of giving lectures to social workers. So in areas where people deal with human beings, in area where people deal with conflicts, but don't have any reference to analytical psychology. So don't have any knowledge or any sort of notion of analyzing something more in depth. So, but I think Jungian psychology has a lot to contribute to these areas, although it's not explicit. So to the first part, it's interesting, if you look at the papers or in the magazines in the last couple of months, something become very popular, and that is to make rankings not, just about the welfare, but also rankings, where are people the happiest? You know, you've heard of that probably. So one tries to find out how and where do people actually, where are people content with their lives? And it's interesting, of course, it varies what one finds out. Once there was a ranking done, that was some time ago, by the University of Greenwich, by the Geographical Society of Greenwich. They did a ranking to find which is the best place in the world to live in, and they found out it's Greenwich. Very objective ranking. But the other rankings you see, which is done with have more items, then, you have items, are you content, are you happy, or would you like to sort of leave your country, would you like to stay in your country, are you content with... So you have different rankings, and usually in the rankings, the results vary. Usually, Switzerland comes out quite high, but other countries also. The country in Europe which is lowest, usually, you can imagine, is Albania. In Albania, I think 60-70% of the people want to emigrate. So that's a country where, according to these rankings. But what is interesting, these rankings also, there's a lot, they put a lot of importance on, how much distraction have you got, how much leisure time have you got. So leisure time, distraction, and material goods. How do you live? Do you have a car? Do you have a big refrigerator? All these things also play a high role in the definition of happiness. So if you look at the rankings, there are very materialistic in some way, not by the Geographical Institute of Greenwich. They just looked at the weather probably and the surroundings. But the newer rankings, there's a lot of sort of very materialistic things in it. So that the quest for happiness, the quest for content is something, of course, which is very important for a lot of people. It's understood. If you ask people, you know, what do you want to do? They say, well, I want to lead a happy life, a content life. I want to be, you know, achieve certain goals. That's what they say. Now, there's certain difficulties. You know, if you ask people what they would want to do, you get answers. And the naive notion is a notion which is even upheld in psychology, which is upheld in a lot of surveys. The naive notion is, of course, that what people say is that what people really live and really believe and really act on. So one usually thinks they're congruent, what someone says and what someone does, what someone says and what someone believes. Of course, one knows if one looks a bit more in depth or if one deals with psychology, one knows that this is, of course, not the case. If you ask someone opinion about himself, about the world, what you actually get is a description, and what you actually get is a description of his self-image. So we all have certain images of ourselves, of our lives, certain ideas about our lives, and our self-image is, of course, not a mirror of our personalities. Our self-image is, of course, doesn't reflect actually the way we really are, but our self-image is, of course, delusional. So it has to be delusional because the purpose of our self-image is not actually to confront us with revelations or knowledge about ourselves. The purpose of our self-image is to make life possible with ourselves, so we can bear ourselves. So in the morning, when we look ourselves into the mirror, we conclude it's still worthwhile to present this human being to other human beings. That's actually the notion of our self-image. And if we were well and healthy, if we were well and healthy and active, and that's very important. By active, I mean we go out, if we pursue a job, have a family, that's actually the main purpose of the self-image. And of course, we all think it's different. We all believe actually we're the great exception. We know a little bit more about ourselves than, you know, our neighbors, our aunts or so, you know, but we're a bit more knowledgeable. But actually, I think it's not the case. And you can see that when you ask people, I mean, about certain traits, you'd say, well, you know, there's a survey that's been done about American professors. They ask them, how do you value your intelligence and originality? You know, and one found out that more than 90% of the professors of university in the United States, they put themselves in the 2% most intelligent, original professors, you know. And they firmly believe that. But there's many surveys which are have the same results, like the Swedish bus drivers. They say 80% of the Swedish bus drivers think they belong to the 2 or 3% most talented and competent bus drivers. So you have, in most of the areas, you have that we somehow keep up a delusional image of how we are, what we are, and we try to avoid it. We try to avoid other insights. And that's important. I think that's the mentalese we create. That's the image we create in our minds in order that we move, in order that we do something. Interestingly, it, of course, self-revelations or more deep insights are more possible when we're a little bit in a depression, in a crisis. So in moments of crisis, we're a lot more realistic. But when we're not in a crisis, when we're optimistic, doing something, we're delusional. There's some very simple exercise which one did once, where one asked people to throw, I think, a stone or something, or a ball, and they had to guess how far they could throw this ball or stone. And people who were depressed were a lot more accurate in their predictions. People who were not depressed, they overestimated their possibilities. And so actually, you know, Jung points out that again and again, Jung points out that actually so-called depression, retreating, also has significance, also has a meaning, is not just we're not just at fault, but it also has a psychological meaning. So, but the interesting thing is that actually the self-image is not a mirror, actually, of how we are. Now, if you look at the contents of our self-image, how we describe each other, we see that what we say about each other is usually results not just out of a personal reflection, a sort of in-deep thinking, a sort of reflection of our personal lives, but contains a lot of references to our surrounding, to our the group of people we belong to the culture we belong to. So when we describe traits of ourselves, we actually describe this culture we belong to. But we attribute it, of course, to ourselves. So you might say, of course, for instance, Switzerland, everyone would say, well, I'm tolerant. I'm a tolerant human being. No one would say, I'm absolutely intolerant. Or one say, this is something you hear. I hear it a lot from my students when they describe, they have to describe this. They say, well, I'm a very open human being. I always wonder, what does it mean, openness, you know, but I'm open. So you use words, or I'm very interested, I'm curious. So you take words which actually are a reference to the culture you belong to, and not really something which results from your own personality. You can see this, for instance, when you read ads, you know, sort of, well, I forgot the word now, the ads where people, you know, trying to find a partner, you know. Personal ads, when you read them, you know, they started about 200 years ago in the papers. Someone would look for a man or a woman, and it's very interesting when you look at traits, how someone presented him or herself. You know, as a woman, you presented yourself in 1810, 1820, obedient woman, good in housekeeping, looks for man with regular income. That was very so that was very explicit. So nobody would have place an ad like that nowadays. You know, you say, well, in Switzerland, what is very popular now, someone is looking for someone who's able to steal horses together. And I often wonder, how many horses are there in our country, which one could steal, because it's a metaphor. So you could see there and things like that, that it varies. So the way we present ourselves is actually shows our embeddedness with the respective culture we belong to. And this all happens unconscious. So of course we're formed by the culture we belong to, we're cultural beings. And this concerns also our interests. This concerns also our goals. This concerns also the way of life we're leading. So we're leading a life which is a function actually of the surrounding we belong to. You could see this, for instance, in our country with the mountains. You know, these mountains nowadays, people stare at these mountains, and a lot of people think they're beautiful and nice to look at. But this is a new phenomenon. As you might know, until about 200 years ago, these mountains were irrelevant. They were dangerous. They were the area where the lost souls went. So when someone died and could not ascend to heaven, they got stuck in the mountains. So you wouldn't want to go there, because you might meet all these bad people whose souls are not liberated, are still stuck in the mountains. And it was actually the British who came up, we were completely ignorant of all these myths and traditions in Switzerland. They just walked up there, you know, and they ignored all these myths and stories there and said, well, this is kind of beautiful up here, so why not have a party or picnic? And so so the ignorance of the British, the English in those days, actually brought the Swiss tourist industry into developing. So, but the Swiss themselves would have never done that because, you know, you don't go up in the mountains, also they're too dangerous and so. So you see, actually, the way we value something, the way we see, the way we perceive our surrounding, what we select is connected actually to the culture we belong to, the culture we look at. Nowadays, of course, in Switzerland, we're learning a lot, and they start to change the sceneries according to the wishes of Indian and Chinese tourists, because once they could see, they want to see other things, they want to detect other things, so you see, have a development. So what we see, we're a cultural human beings, and our behavior is always part of the surrounding. Our way we perceive ourselves is always part as a reference. Now, as we are cultural beings, of course, our doings reveal our embedment in culture. And now if one looks what human beings are striving for, of course, you see happiness, fun, that's something which is very important, to have fun. And there also you could see changes. For instance, in our country, sports became very, very important. And I think in many countries, and in Switzerland is a country which is, interesting enough, people are getting slimmer, not fatter. So they get, the obesity is actually not increasing, but you know, people get slimmer and slimmer. So there's like a craze, you know, of, and one reason is that somehow there's an image of how one has to present one's body, and the body image is somehow associated to happiness. So you're not allowed, actually, when you work, you shouldn't have a stomach, you shouldn't be too, you should be able to move. I can see this in when I work with schoolhouses. If you're over 30, 40, you know, young people, they can go along the hallways very slowly, you know, sort of slow movements, you know, sort of, as a, they don't have to be agile because they're young, you know. But the older you get, the quicker you have to move. So I can see in schoolhouses that 30, 40, 50 year olds old, they would jump up the stairs, you know, in order to give a sign, we're quick, we're moving. I could detect that also, that in Obama, when he goes up to a pulpit, he always makes kind of jumps up there. So that's the same notion, you have to jump, sort of, oh, I'm fit, I'm very young. So. And so this is something you can see, it's a cultural trait, you know, the body becomes actually a focus of achieving happiness, concentrating body, and we're ready to go through a lot of torture also to achieve that goal, with all these torture chambers we've got around in our country, where you even exhibit yourself, you stand there, you have a mirror, and you present yourself how you're torturing yourself. And you could see the focus on the body with the colors, you know, the colorful dressings people wear. This is also an interesting development. If you look at the way the colors, it used to be that as a grown-up, you dressed more modestly, you know, when you were old. And you didn't dress so adolescent, you know, with adolescent colors. That was something you would never do. And also not so tight and so, but now you see development that you're allowed, even if you're 30, 40, 50, to dress very with tight clothes, make awkward movements, torture yourself, and you not have these outlandish colors. So you see there that you see, and of course everyone makes his own distinct choice, thinks I'm doing it for myself, but in pursuing actually fulfillment, pursuing actually happiness combined, you know, with the way you look, the body. So this is something which you could see is a cultural craze or a cultural sensation. But you have other areas, of course. For instance, other areas, you know, in pursuing sort of happiness and other areas is, of course, in our country is very important. I think, in contrast to the United States, is having holidays. So holidays is something which is extremely important, I think, in France and in Switzerland. And also in Italy. So if you have, you know, you at least would have 3 or 4 times a year you would have to have a holiday, which would last maybe 2 weeks, you know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So this is a common trait in our country. And you survive or you're happy when you can talk about your next holidays. So it's a conversation piece. So now people would ask each other, oh, hi, where are you going this summer? You know, not are you going somewhere? And if someone says, well, I'm staying here, so he must have a kind of problem. You know? or not enough money. But you would say, where are you going to? And where are you going to in fall? And so it repeats, you know. And of course, over Christmas, you know, winter, what are you doing there? Then it's more sportive. Or you go to the Caribbean, you know, or to Indonesia someplace. So holidays also has become a cultural pattern that you move your body out. And again, you go through sort of very tedious acts. You have to go to the airport very early, usually. You have to wait in line. You have sort of all these sort of devaluing rituals, questions which are asked you. You know, there, and you sit in these awkward little chairs, unless you travel first class. So you have also this tremendous, torturous kind of intermediate acts where you go somewhere so you can place your body maybe somewhere and get a sunburn. You know, so these are acts you can see which human beings do, you know, so they move their body outside and go to another surrounding, and it usually makes a tremendous difference on them. The moment they are there, they change their demeanor, their whole attitude. Suddenly they're open, you know, suddenly they start to talk to people when they go into a restaurant. They start to talk about their children, their background, their jobs. They start to be relaxed. They start to sit around and just stare somewhere. So the whole behavior pattern starts to change when they move their body outside. So in our country, you could see that, you know, being holidaying, you know, holy days, you know, to have that, you have to move your body outside. And it's become a pattern which is like a necessity or a curse. But, you know, just to be here is more difficult. This contrasts, for instance, one often says that, you know, in the medieval days people worked all the time, you know, so all the time they never actually had any holidays. But what they actually did, they had their holidays included in their average time. So they would start working and then they would start talking a little bit and they would go out, they would have a drink, then come back. And so it was actually included. And what we've got now, that while you're working, you're in a concentrated state, so you can be relieved and go somewhere and then be in a completely different state. So holidays is also something which is a phenomena in our country, that you travel. Sometimes when you're a bit more wealthy, of course, you make this more concrete by owning different houses. You know, that's become, in our country, some kind of a trade among many groups. So you just, of course, you have a house in Tuscany, but then everyone has an apartment or a house in the mountains, that's understood. But you might have something in Greek too, in an island, and so you have different houses, or even in Florida, you might own something. So if you're a bit more affluent, you somehow symbolize that, you somehow make it more concrete by owning. And it's very interesting, these colleagues I know have got different houses, they need to have to do a lot of sacrifice again, you know, sacrifice, for like perhaps not just by traveling, but sacrifice by having to dedicate themselves to their houses. You know, because the roof might be leaking, you know, or maybe they have problems with the gardener, and then maybe someone is stealing. So they're actually always occupied, worried with something which is not working. I have a friend of mine, he has 8 houses, and he continuously has some house, there's some kind of problem. But, you know, it belongs to happiness, it belongs to that pattern that you own different houses, different places, you mark yourself. So this is a typical trait in our societies, you have different houses. But then you have other areas, you know, we're talking about, you know, how to be happy. Another area which is also very important is, of course, buying material goods, to buy. And now, the naive idea of buying is, of course, that you buy things you need in order to fulfill your necessities, your milk, eggs, and so on. Most of the people believe they actually go and buy things which they they need, you know, and they write down. But actually, when you look at it more closely, it goes on completely different. For instance, just to start off, you see that when people write something down on a list and go and do their shoppings, they might write, I need eggs, I need some bread, and so, and then they go into a shopping center and so, and when they get out, you know, and ask maid service, and ask people, what did you buy? And then, you know, 80-90% of the people say, well, I went in and I bought what was on the list. You know, I bought eggs, I bought bread, I bought cornflakes and so. But then one checked what was in the cart. And most of the time, there was completely different things in the cart than on the list. So there was a difference. And then if you confronted them, but here you bought a bottle of wine, and here you bought some chocolate. What about that? Oh, that's something, because I just remembered my sister is coming tonight, so I thought we'd buy a bottle of wine. Oh, the chocolate. Oh, yes, my daughter. There was always a perfectly sound explanation, but people don't buy what they actually intend to buy. Usually when they go, they buy something else. Of course, there's some compulsive people who buy to lists, but often people... Now, what does it mean? I think buying is not just, you know, going into buying a shopping mall is not just the act of getting the things which we need, but it's somehow it's a semi-flow. It's actually an area where you allow yourself being seduced. Seduced by all these things which somehow create fantasies in you, sort of taught you to imagine something. We could say shopping malls are areas of imagination. So you go there, and advertisements and so is a way of, you know, you can see it also when you look at how the people move. In contrast, for instance, to schoolhouses, universities, or train stations, that's where people move slowly. You know, they're very sort of graciously, they move around, so, and look at the things, they interact, they might take something, put it away, take it again. So it's a completely different behavior pattern. And then actually sort of they have a kind of interaction with these objects which might seem attractive, less attractive, repulsive. They go around and let themselves being stimulated by all these inputs they get, you know, these images, speak images, and also, of course, the noises, and then they choose something. In some areas, you know, even the music has been tuned to that. There's music in the background, and the music is specially done in some shopping centers that after a while it gets a bit louder, and then the music goes to a climax, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And when the climax comes, people usually buy something. So you're in tune. You're in tune with what you hear, in tune with what you see, so there's a general flow when you go and do buying. Also there, it's interesting to see the differences between the various cultures. You know, what is being offered, of course, again, reflects the different cultures. For a while, I did sort of kind of ethnographic studies. I went to the shopping malls of the various countries and started to try to distinguish what do they actually present, what exhibit, you know, what are the goods which actually you could buy. And within Europe, there's great differences. For instance, in Switzerland, when you go to a shopping center, one area which is very, takes up a lot of space and which is very present is, of course, cheese, milk products, you know, it's very large. And they present it and you have to smell it, you know, scent of cheese. So that's a very, for Swiss people, that's a very ritualistic act, you know, being tuned. It's not just cheese, it's of course a mountain, it's the cows, cow being the national symbol, you know, so you're there, it's somehow you get embedded by the whole Swissness in some way because of the cheese. That's very important in our country. When you go to France, for instance, the area, and also similar in Italy, the area which is very important is wine. The wine sections are usually very at the beginning, very present, so you can see tuning in to wine and the different vineyards, you know, the different types of wine. That's important. Or when you go, of course, to Japan, of course, as you understand, it's the fish, fish, which are very important. So this is the sea, it's a reference to the sea around them. So every country, and in England, what is important, Great Britain, there you have animal food, you know. How do you call it? Food for cats and for dogs. How do you call it? I forgot the right. Pet food, yes. Pet food. You have a lot of pet food. So the section for pet food is one of the largest sections. So it shows the way they let the animal spirits domesticated, you know, in their country. So it's a reference to living in houses, but also including the animals. No wild animals, but they somehow make reference to animals, and they have to always, you know, pacify them. It's very important in their own civilized surroundings. So you could see the different patterns. In the United States, I also made a survey, and there's one area which we don't have. That's pills and things like that. Different pills, you know. Pharmacies. That's some. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
That's something.
You know where you are everywhere.
That's it's at one end it's pharmacy.
On the other end it's fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. So it's pharmacies. That's something which we don't have in Europe. The presence of the pharmacies. So you can see pharmacies. So it reflects actually what you buy also reflects the culture or the values you have. So it's like a flow. But also when you look at what you listen to, and it's very interesting if you look at what does a culture select, what kind of noise, of course, originally, of course, the world is a place which is not that noisy, nor rather silent. If you go up to the mountains, it's very silent there. You know, you might hear a cracking, you might hear an avalanche, you might hear, but if you don't, you know, if you... I'm not talking about animals, it's a very silent place. Silence is something which is basically unbearable. I have a colleague who's a geologist, and he went with another colleague to a valley in Antarctica which didn't have any water, so it was completely dry. And he said when the wind was still, it was absolutely silent. You didn't hear anything at all. He said what actually then happened is the relationship to his friend got very tense. They started to have quarrels. They started to not be able to bear each other. He got annoyed by the breathing, you know, and vice versa. So it was unbearable to be there because it was too silent. So the world is very silent, and we human beings come into a world which is extremely silent, and we probably can't bear it. So we start to make noises. We start to select noises, and sort of one way possibility is that we create an urban surrounding which has noises, and it's interesting to see that we have a kind of ambivalence towards noises. On one hand, we're aggravated by noise; we think we don't want all this noise, and you can see when you look at the European cities, especially, they became very, very quiet. When you go back to the 18th, 19th, 16th century, for instance, in Zurich in the 16th, 17th century, and probably also in Einsiedeln, it was an extremely noisy place. You had constant noise. You had this these wheels from the carriages, which were made out of metal, and they went on cobblestones, and that made a tremendous noise. You had the horses, of course. The horses could be noisy. Then you had people shouting, crying, you know, so there was also a lot of noise. You had the blacksmith, so you had a lot of noise. And it became more and more and more and more quiet. So we're trying to quiet down the noise. But it's interesting that we also reintroduce new noises. You know, we introduce noises by having amplifiers, by music, or there's a car, you know, by cars with amplifiers. And there the ambivalence shows also that usually when a new noise is introduced, it's identified symbolically. For instance, you could see it when trains started, you know, being introduced in urban, in Western societies, People were fascinated by the noise of the trains, and it meant some kind of connectedness. They would listen to a steam engine, you know, it was something wonderful. So, I even know a colleague of mine, and he had a disc, and in the evening when he would get home and wanted to have some relaxation, he would listen to the sounds of the different steam engines throughout the world. You know, sit there and say, now, listen to this. This is the South African, da 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 da. And now he'd listen to this is an American Canadian train. And he could detect exactly which locomotive made what noise, and it gave him a feeling of exhilaration. Also, when the planes were introduced, you know, the planes in the 50s and 60s, you could connect to the various planes through the noise they made. You could realize this is now a conveyor, you know, coming, or a Coronado. The noises were, the planes were identified because the planes then made decent noise. You know, so they were loud enough so you could connect to them, you could feel the energy. And with cars, it's the same. Cars used to be more noisy, so you could connect to the engine. Now it needs mechanics who have a very special ear in order to detect it. So actually, when noises, we select the noises, and the noises usually, through the selection of our noises, we express our values, you know, what we value and what we're connected with. And we used to be very connected to the energies we had, to the potentials we had, and that got actually more and more quiet. And nowadays I think we're trying to quiet down, and noises are going to the background. But of course there's other noises, and that's interesting, of course, noises we human beings make. You know, we human beings start to use our voice in order to make some noise. And then it's also interesting to see how this developed. Actually, to make noise used to be a mean replacement of grooming. One says that when you look at chimpanzees, I'll put this here now, it's a bit better. If you look at chimpanzees apparently, according to Franz De Waal, spend a lot of time just fooling around, not doing anything, you know, scratching each other's back, sort of running after each other, playing hide and seek, maybe, you know, just fooling around, and apparently they played 80% of the time doing this. As they developed, according to De Waal, and this fooling around got more and more replaced by exchanging noises. You know, so the chimpanzees would start, instead of scratching each other's back, they would exchange similar noises. So this meant that you belong to a group. You had distinct noises, you know, belonging to each other's group. And one says that people, when they talk, it's actually a substitute for grooming. So we don't groom, we don't scratch each other's back, we don't run after each other the way, so we don't touch each other, but we make noises, we exchange noises. So when people come together, they exchange a lot of noises, but actually what they do is they groom, they try to create a kind of cohesiveness out of the noises we make. And I think this is an important trait. So we make a lot of noise, you know, we select noises in order to be embedded in a certain culture. And there again, there is a tendency, there's an ambivalence, but we need noise in order to have a feeling also for happiness, contentness, so noises are important. Of course, in noise, there's other different levels of noise, and the highest, the most developed category of noise is, of course, music. Music is actually noise which is detached from any function, which doesn't have any immediate function, immediate purpose, but it's just there playing and making something artistic out of noise. And music is actually the kind of noise where we can somehow enjoy something or be something without being sort of related to something, something, a major challenge. Another way, a typical trait, is of course stories. It's interesting that, you know, two happiness, one basic momentum in happiness is also that you can listen to stories. Human beings, in order to be more content, they want to hear something. And the stories are told, of course, in our cultures in very different ways. This is something I try to do in mythodrama, to do it therapeutically. But it's interesting to see that, you know, stories are, of course, nowadays being told through the media, through television, through papers. And usually we ourselves believe, well, these stories, they just relate the actual situations which are outside, politically, culturally, you know, we're in contact. But as you know, of course, we only probably hear about from 1% or less than 1% of what is actually happening outside. So actually it's just pure storytelling. So we're hearing stories of what was happening, but these stories are selected in order to put us in a certain mood, in order to put us in a certain emotional state. They have to emotionalize us. And these stories, of course, they have to pick up then the major issues to which we then might react emotionally or irritated. And there again, it's interesting if you look at these stories, you see stories about sort of apocalyptic stories are very important. Human beings always loved apocalyptic stories. The more apocalyptic story, when they heard apocalyptic stories, interesting enough, they would get more happy. Sort of more accelerated. Someone told me just last Saturday, the best nightclubs in the world are in Beirut, because that's where people really have fun. You know, because the Hezbollah and all this dangers and the war in Syria. So people go there, they're so confronted with these horrible stories, so the people who live there, they go and they can really party in contrast. So that's what one says, you know, if you really want to do nightclubbing, go to Beirut. So, stories, we have a lot of apocalyptic stories, and as you know, there's always again and again apocalyptic stories which arouse, which people always believe, firmly believe, it's the reality. For a time in the year 1000, the idea was that Europe would, that the world would, there would be the end of the world, because the year 1000 was coming, and as you know, several towns were deserted even. People freaked out, you know, because now it's the end of the world. So that one thought then was the end of the world. But also you could see it 20, 30 years ago in Switzerland, one thought that the forests would disappear, and so actually nature would disappear. So it was also an apocalyptic story. Now we have the issue of climate warming. Again, we all believe in it. We're all absolutely certain that's the case. If you look at it psychologically, it's the same story. You know, cultures always develop stories about apocalyptic image, and apparently we need it. I'm not saying it's not true, you know, but maybe, I don't know. It's just very interesting that this is so firm, so certain. And if you look back, you see the same phenomenon. I could give you another 5-6 examples where people had an apocalyptic vision of the world, and it turned out suddenly it was just hot air. It was actually, it was just one of these images actually they needed. So apparently we need apocalyptic images in order to somehow be content. We need to be in contact. It's interesting if you look at the film industry in the 30s in Europe. The films in the 30s was a lot about romance, love, leisure, entertainment. So the apocalyptic vision was, of course, a reality around. You heard stories. But it changed people somehow. So this is something we need stories. And stories need to contain some kind of shadowy issue. And we could not bear just to hear stories about good things, you know. I remember a school just nearby, they tried to do this. They wanted to make a radio. They told the children, the elders, let's make a radio for the school, and it will be transmitted in the whole schoolhouse every day for 15 minutes. And one school class was responsible to make it a radio. And everyone was for it, and then the teacher had one consideration. They said to the students, You're only allowed to have this radio. I'm trying to put this in the right place. Just a moment. What should I think it's I stand like this. Okay. Now I got the position. Perfect position.
It may be
this one, yes?
With your phone?
No, that's not possible, because that's cut off.
Is it completely
yes.
off?
Yes, that's off, completely off, so it's not, can't be that.
Then
okay.
Gonna
happen. Yeah, but I'll just, I'll put on an awkward position from time to time, so it's not, it's adapting to the surrounding, okay? it was interesting, then the teacher said, we'll only allow this project if you just concentrate on good news, no bad news. And of course it turned out a complete catastrophe.
Right.
Nobody just wants to hear the good news. It's just not possible, we can't bear it. Interesting enough, also, if you look at human beings, before they go to sleep, you know, in the evening, before they, what they do, they watch the evening news, you know. And the evening news is about all the horrors in the world, and then we get aggravated by all these horrors we hear, and then we go into bed and sleep nicely. So it's something in our soul, we have to be in contact with this. So stories, human beings don't just need, you know, traveling, sports, physical, but they also seem to need stories in order to be content or satisfied. So you see, actually, if you look at human beings in their culture, there's some kind embedded in their, they have cultural habits which reflect, you know, the society we belong to. Now, I actually want to come to the second part. I wonder if we should start the break now, because the second part will just approach. So we'll start the break now. How come we so? 15 minutes.